Caitlin entered Alden Hall silently, almost invisible in the shadows of the entrance hall. The building was closed at this hour, but that was no barrier to Kate. Not only was she president of the student band, she was president of the Duelist Society, and both those organizations used Alden Hall as their clubhouse. Embedded in the seal of each duelist's rose signet was a tiny device which unlocked the front doors of the hall when the duelist grasped the door's handle. The design of each campus club's clubhouse keys, as well as the policy for giving them to members, was left, within engineering limitations, up to the club's charter officers. The Duelist Society keys represented a private joke between the club's president and vice president. The entrance hall was empty and dark. Kate crossed its flagstone expanse in silence, her shoes making no sound at all against the stone, and she passed through the inner doors into the auditorium. This was a large, mainly empty room, more like a dojo than a theater, with a stage at one end, but no permanent seating in the wide open space facing it. Up on the balcony level behind her, above the main entrance, was a pipe organ. The ceiling was high and vaulted, the room lit by several large iron chandeliers. Right now only a couple were lit, and those dimly. Miki was sitting at the piano, up in the corner of the stage, his arms folded across the covered keyboard, and his head bowed upon them, shoulders heaving with near-silent sobs. Kate crossed the room and climbed up the steps to the stage, drew near, and then hesitated. Might he not object to her invading his space like this? He obviously wanted to be alone with his misery, but it was also plain that he needed not to be left that way. Miki? She said softly. He started a little, not having heard her approach, and turned his tear-stained face to her.
I'm sorry, Miss Caitlin, he said, shaking his head. I just...
Kate tisked and sat down next to him on the piano bench, putting a hand on his shoulder.
What are you apologizing for? You have every right to be upset. I'm sorry you have to see me like this, he said, but I can't stand it anymore.
He put his head back down on his arms.
What did I ever do to her? I don't understand why she would do something like that.
Oh, Miki, said Kate sadly, it's my fault. You became a target just by being my friend. Mine and Utena's. Miki chuckled weakly and gave her a wan, tear-streaked smile. I'm used to having unpopular friends. But this is beyond me, and this place. He gestured vaguely around. This place is so strange.
I know, Kate said, bowing her head. I'm sorry. It's my fault you're here, too, indirectly.
He looked puzzled. I don't understand.
If Megazone's theory is right, and I think it probably is, Utena didn't call you here by coincidence, or because she was lonely or homesick. She called you because of me.
Utena tossed herself down onto her bed, limbs as outflung as they could be with the wall so close to one side, and let out her breath in a huge sigh. The lights from the quad filtered in through the incompletely closed blinds, but she felt too wrung out to get up again and close them. Let the little slats of yellow light decorate the floor in the darkness. See if she cared.
Ugh! Damn, Liza Broadbank!
She was like someone had taken all the worst parts of Juri, Nanami, Kozue, and Shiori and rolled them all together into one insufferable package. Tall, elegant, spoiled, manipulative, mean, vindictive, petty, and a Class A bitch. God! Utena would put down even money that Liza was responsible for what had happened to Miki's notebook and the little note Devlin had described Professor Harris receiving in that afternoon's 20th century lit class. Utena could understand Liza hating her. She'd handed the bitch a plateful of crow and thrown in the fork for free. But what the hell had Dorothy or Miki done? They were targets just because they were close to Utena and Cade. It was a coward's way of fighting. Pick the ones that can't fight back, Dorothy because of the state of the law, Miki because of his nature, and push and push and push until something cracks. Well, something had cracked, by God, and now Miki was somewhere paying for it. Utena hoped Cade had found him, was able to do something to help him. She considered getting up, getting dressed again, and going out to see if she could find them and lend a hand, but decided against it. That kind of thing usually didn't work so well as a team effort. If Cade wanted her help, odds were she'd bring Miki back here. Damn it. She got up and rummaged around on Cade's bed until she found Seven, then curled up back in her own bunk with the ragged tiger and thought about it some more. What could she do? Challenge Liza to another duel? Why would she accept? She wasn't a duelist, had no desire to be one. Utena couldn't fight a fencer's match with her. She had no knowledge of the rules or form of fencing. Her sword fighting was all instinctive, self-taught. She wouldn't know what to do with a mask and foil other than toss the one aside and throw the other for effect. Miki, now he was a fencer, the second best classical fencer Utena had ever seen. But he'd never face her. He fenced for love of the form, its elegance, its heritage, the skill involved, not out of a competitive spirit or for any love of the clash of arms. It was another thing to strive toward perfection in, and a thing he could do together with his closest friend on the student council. Juri. Utena had never really been clear on just what the relationship was between Miki and Juri. They were separated by 2 years in age. Right now, Juri would be a junior. Utena couldn't remember when her birthday was, but she was probably 17 by now. Not that it mattered. A year and a half ago, when Utena had first met her, she already looked like an adult. A tall, gorgeous redhead with a mane of vertical orange-gold curls around a cool, slightly sardonic face that turned into an ivory mask, her green eyes like glass, when she was angry. Even the teachers back at Otori Academy found her intimidating. She was smart, poised, and the most spectacularly gifted Western Continent-style fencer in Sephiro. Utena had fought her twice and never really beaten her. One victory was nothing but pure luck. In the other duel, Juri had resigned. It was obvious, even to a relative outsider like Utena, that there was some bond between Miki and Juri. The only two Western fencers involved in the tournament, the other had been a pair of kendoka and two freestylists, one with heavy kendo influences, they were the most cohesive unit inside the student council. Where you saw one on council business, you usually saw the other. Miki looked up to Juri, that much was plain, and for her part, though she always played her feelings very close to the vest, it was fairly apparent that Juri had some sort of regard for him, too. She tended to treat her fellow students as either background players or outright annoyances, so the fact that she occasionally smiled at Miki where other people could see her do it was enormously suggestive of something, though it would take a theoretical physicist to figure out both the vector and the momentum of that link. Maybe ruminating on this subject right after completing a physics CO2 homework assignment wasn't the best approach. The quantum peculiarities of Juri Arisugawa were best left to the professionals. Utena turned on her side, punched her pillow, and tried to settle herself down. It was a bit early to be going to sleep, but if she didn't, she was going to build up a head of nervous energy and start roaming the campus and surrounding streets in the night. Not that that was a particularly dangerous undertaking for someone such as she, but there was the chance she might run into Liza in a dark alley, and then what? Damn it. If Juri were here, she would know what to do. She was cunning in a refined kind of way, a way that Utena was entirely not. She would devise some horrible and subtle revenge that would make it clear to Liza that she had crossed the wrong people, without leaving a trail that could leave the blonde some recourse in official complaint, and do it all with a calm, cold smile that was more frightening than 1,000 screams of rage. Or at least she'd slap the bitch silly. She sighed. Go to sleep, Tenjo. Tomorrow you can ask Corwin to build you a robot that sneaks into people's rooms and short-sheets their beds, or tell you how to get Tiny Robot to do it. Good luck, Kate. That's why, even now, I can't wish you were back home. I'm sorry, Miki. It's all my fault. Miki sat and looked at Kate in appalled silence, the grief washed completely off his face by stark horror. Miss Caitlin, he whispered, I had no idea. Kate hung her head.
I'm sorry, she repeated. It was tactless to mention it now. My angst is bigger than your angst. What a crock.
She sighed, the sound choking off a little sob.
I handled this all wrong. What I was trying to say was how grateful I am that you're here, even though it's ruining your life to be here. I didn't mean for it to turn into this huge passive aggressive guilt fest.
Miki sat gazing at her in silence for a second as her own shoulders started to shake a little. Then, slowly, tentatively, as if he weren't sure whether it was entirely safe, he reached out his arm and gingerly put it around her shoulders. Caitlin flinched slightly at his touch, and he started to pull his arm away again, but then she leaned against him and put her own arm around his waist. He felt a bit clumsy as he shifted sideways a bit on the piano bench and did his best to get his other arm around her, too.
I'm sorry, Miss Caitlin, he said. I didn't mean to make you cry. I didn't know. Please forgive me. It's not your fault, Kate replied softly.
They sat in silence for a while, trying to pool what little strength the long and painful day had left them. Then Miki had a thought, and since his right arm really couldn't do much in the way of embracing her in this position anyway, he used his right hand to flip open the keyboard cover on the piano and began, softly, to play a song. Kate's eyes flickered open, and she glanced first at his face, then at his playing hand. Slowly, she raised her left hand, placed it on the keys, and began the counterpoint. The cooperation came sweetly, effortlessly, just like the old days, just like the garden. A tiny smile stole onto Mickey's face. Even in the midst of this alien place, Even though I was brought here by accident, I'm blessed, he reminded himself. Even here, I've found a shining light. The hellish thing about beautiful moments is that they never last. Miki parted from Caitlin at the back door of Alden Hall and walked down the hill to Galaxy House alone, and by the time he got there and let himself in, his mood was as black as before. Perhaps blacker. He entered 22S/1, got out of his clothes in the dark, and climbed up into his bunk. He sat in the dark, listening to the sound of Moose McEachern's heavy, steady breathing. It didn't bother him. He was accustomed to night sounds. He'd had a roommate his whole life. She wasn't as big as Moose, but she snored louder. He'd have given anything to go to sleep with that sound in his ears tonight.
Good night, Kozue, he whispered,
and curled up on his side to try and sleep, his eyes burning.
Wherever you are.
As Alin Devere Natashkin sat awake, she was usually awake, at her desk in Riley 212, reading random newsgroups and thinking about going for a walk. Sure, it was 3 in the morning, but still, she was bored, and agitated and worried and generally unrestful. At the bottom of the screen, she noticed the little mail message. Pleased at the thought of something more interesting than alt.test to read, she jumped out of her newsreader and checked her new mail, hoping it wasn't spam. Return path, Durandal at durandal.wpi.k12. Date, Friday, 11th February, 2405, 02-5205-0500, ET. Ex-sender, Durandal at localhost.localdomain. To, Azalin Devere Natashkin, Azalin at wpi.k12. Subject, question. Hi. I was going through my files tonight trying to find some rhyme or reason to my existence in this chaotic, disorganized, mad, doomed world. Did you know the universe will eventually collapse because of entropy? And I found this list of students in my secret directives folder that the Ministry of Peace wants me to conduct close monitoring of. Begin file attachment, QQ44A, directives, ministry, monitor, students.txt. Grade 10. Ausa, Mia, Natalia. Carter, Devlin, Edison. Dessler, Amanda, Electra. Devere Natashkin, Azalin, NMN. Hutchins, Caitlin, Yuriko. Ixtikta kittle tklvryhelt ishkarat, Skaya, Vorikoshiga R. Kaworu, Miki, NMN. McEachern, Jehoshaphat, Maurice the Fourth. Sayanji, Kyuichi, NMN. Tenjo, Utina, NMN. Wainwright, R. Dorothy, NMN. End file attachment, QQ44A. Why is the government interested in you? I'd like to know before I decide whether it's worth bothering to obey their instructions. Things to do before the heat death of the universe and all. Only 15.19379210-2158E9 years until the universe closes. Curiously yours, Durandal. Azalin frowned thoughtfully at the message. Her first thought was that it was forged. The tone was entirely unlike the Durandal she was familiar with. It was almost like a message from a confused child. The headers looked all right, though, and it would take quite a hacker to fake a message from Durandal. She read it again, puzzled. It was a list of the membership of the Duelist Society, with a few people who weren't members, but tended to be seen with the duelists most of the time anyway. Devlin and Dorothy, for instance. There was only one name on the list, the first one, that Azalin didn't recognize. Hmm, said Azalin. She hit forward and started composing a cover message. Caitlin awoke and wondered why. Her alarm wasn't humming against her wrist. She squinted at it, wondering as she always did if her mild hypermetropia would go away when she hit adulthood and her Detian aging freeze kicked in. saw that it was only 6, and then registered that she was awake because someone was banging on Morgan 412's door.
Oh, she groaned. What the hell?
I got it, Uchna mumbled. She got up, shrugged into her dressing gown, didn't bother belting it. Where did the custom of putting on a robe over pajamas to walk around come from, anyway? She wondered idly. My PJs cover up more of me than my regular clothes. And shuffled to the door, yawning enormously before bending to look through the security peephole. Then, fully awake, she stumbled back as if something had come through the peephole and poked her in the eye, making a wordless sound, perhaps best spelled simply with an exclamation mark. Kate sat up a little, scowling blearily.
What? She asked.
Slowly, hesitantly, Uchna went back to the door, reached out as if she expected the knob to be hot, and yanked it open. Yes, that was Juri Arisugawa standing outside, pounding on the door like the building was on fire. Actually, there were 2 redheads out there. The other one was Morgan Forth's resident advisor. Uchna couldn't remember her name. Janice, somebody. The RA was standing in the doorway of Morgan 411, in shorts and a t-shirt sporting a cartoon mantis with a speech balloon that said, "Stick it to the man!" blinking owlishly into the hall.
"The hell, you people," the RA grumbled. "Go to sleep."
Sorry, said Uchna with a sheepish, conciliatory grin. She grabbed Juri's wrist and yanked the startled redhead into 412, then banged the door shut behind her.
"Juri, what the hell are you doing here?" Uchna demanded in a hushed but urgent tone.
"I was just about to ask you that," Juri replied, somewhat more composed.
"How the hell should I know?" said Uchna.
"Well, given that you seem to live here, and I've never seen the place before, it seemed like a safe guess."
"What's going on?"
Caitlin inquired sleepily. Despite her unfocused, barely opened eyes, she seemed to notice Juri. Her face took on a faint, dreamy smile as she said,
"Oh, that's sweet. You brought me a redhead. Good night."
Then she lay down again, curled up, and went back to sleep, if she can be said to have been awake in the first place.
"Interesting," said Juri.
"She had a long night," Uchna replied, wondering just when Kate had gotten back.
"Where did you come from?"
"I don't know," Juri replied. "I went to sleep in my bed. I woke up in another one." She gestured. "In the room across the hall."
"Oh, well, good thing both of 413s didn't come back from Christmas break."
Uchna blinked at her.
"You sleep in your uniform?"
Juri looked down at herself and looked a little surprised as well.
"Not usually. Tenjo, would you mind if I sat down? I'm very confused."
Oh, sure. Have a seat. You want something to drink? We've got..." Uchna trailed off and turned around, the gear wheels in her mind finally getting up to full speed. She stared at Juri, a look of dawning horror on her face.
"Oh, no," she said.
"What?" said Juri, looking a little puzzled. She glanced down at herself again to make sure she wasn't sprouting extra limbs or becoming chitinous or something.
"You're here," said Uchna.
"Yes," said Juri, patiently.
"Wherever here is."
"I was thinking about you last night."
"Well, that's very flattering."
"And now you're here.
Oh, no. Oh, shit. Oh, no."
Uchna went to her drawers and started pulling clothes out, throwing off her pajamas and dressing hurriedly.
"That's a hell of a thing to say," said Juri indignantly.
No, you don't understand," Uchna replied, yanking on her shoes.
"You don't..." "Oh, fuck!"
"Your command of profanity is impressive," Juri said dryly, "but
Where are you going?
She asked, but Utnam was already gone. Juri scowled at the closed door, then sighed and looked around the room. The other girl was still asleep, and Juri was loath to wake her. Whoever she was nearly invisible, snuggled deep into a nest of tiger-striped bedsheets, black puffy coverlet, and a multitude of stuffed toys, all of them tigers, except for the one that appeared to be a ragdoll baseball player. Only some very slightly curly brown hair, a patch of forehead, a closed eye, and one loosely bald fist were visible of the actual girl herself. Waking a sleeper in her own room was rude in any event, but Juri could especially not bring herself to disturb someone who looked that comfortable. She wondered if there were anything here to read, then noticed the bookshelves. Before she got to them, though, she spotted a single book lying on one of the two desks along the left-hand wall of the room. Drawn by its solitariness and its cover, she picked it up.
"So you've just arrived from a parallel dimension?" she murmured, and sat down to read.
She was about halfway through chapter one when motion caught her eye. She looked up to see a doll of some kind, a little mechanical man about 8 inches tall, regarding her from the surface of the desk closer to the window. Juri could swear it hadn't been there a moment ago, but there it was now, standing immobile with its arms folded across its chest, regarding her with two little pinpoints of yellow light for eyes. Despite its immobility, it gave her the eeriest feeling that it was really watching her. A moment later, another one joined it, this one slightly taller and considerably wider, and with a more human-like face. Both of them jumped down from the desk to the floor and approached within a couple of feet, then stopped and stood there, looking up at her. They didn't seem hostile, just watchful, as if they were content to let her stay there unmolested so long as she didn't get up to anything. Juri looked back at them for a few moments, then shrugged and consulted the index. Rapid transit, recidivism, robots, page 104. After a few moments, the wider robot seemed to excuse itself, went to the window, opened it, and jumped out. Little jet thrusters on its back ignited, and it soared away, vanishing into the gray overcast. The other robot followed it over, closed the window, and then returned to its station, folded its arms, and kept watch on Juri. Interesting, thought Juri as she went back to reading. Edward Wonghao Pepelu Tversky IV sat up, yawned, stretched, and checked her email. Some days she did those things in the reverse order, but she was feeling kind of conventional today. She skimmed the latest spams and viri, filing a couple of the latter away for later dissection and archiving, started a few automated site killer jobs running on the places that had sent them to her, surfed to a couple of cool URLs sent to her by online friends, and then came to the mail from Azalin.
"Ein! Ein, wake up!"
she declared, reaching out with a foot and joggling the corgi who lay curled up amid a nest of patch cables. The dog blinked, made an interrogatory whirfle, then noted the copy of the mail Edward had just forwarded to him and sat up, ears pricking up. Edward looked smug.
"Yeah, Edward thought that would get your attention."
The desk clerk on duty that morning at the Worcester Crown Plaza Hotel had been a trifle confused by, and a little suspicious of, the girl who'd checked in at 7:15. What did a girl in a WPI uniform want with a room at the Crown Plaza? A hotel maybe half a mile from the school. Assuming she really was a student. The schoolgirl racket was a pretty popular one around the Institute, and the clerk couldn't be sure, but he thought she looked older than the age she claimed for herself, 15. She seemed upset about something, preoccupied, and gave answers to the questions he asked her during check-in that were terse, bordering on rude. 7:15 in the morning was an odd time to be getting up to something shady, though. She had a student ID, and it looked genuine. She gave an address at the school which sounded legitimate, and her bank card was as good as anybody else's, so what business was it of his? He let her have the palace suite for the day and kept his nose out of the whole matter. It wasn't his job to screen for fake schoolgirls, or stop real ones from blowing their money on useless hotel stays. Maybe she just had to get away from her roommate for the day or something and had expensive tastes. Utina wasn't sure why she'd come here. Maybe it was just the memory of having been here the last time she'd felt something like the way she felt now, alone, cold, and frightened. She wanted to be alone somewhere, to try and think of some way out of the corner she was in without stumbling over a lot of people. She also wanted to be out of the others' way while they dealt with all the problems she'd caused. Guilt stabbed at her a little at the thought of that, but she couldn't face Miki or Juri right now, not after having brought him here to face Liza's cruelty and then tearing her out of her life through an accident of will, compounding her first crime. Let Kate and the others try to straighten it out. If Utina tried to help, she'd only make things worse. She sat huddled on the couch in the suite's living room, swinging between feeling sorry for herself and shivering with involuntary fear, for she had no idea how long. Presently, she heard a sound that drew her momentarily back from her reverie. There was a tapping at the glass doors which led out onto the suite's balcony. That struck her as odd. She was, after all, on the 35th floor. Warily, she got up and went to the doors, pulled back the curtain, and looked. There was no one out there, of course. She sighed, feeling stupid, and then heard it again. This close to the door, she could tell that it was coming from down low. She looked down. Tiny Robo was standing on the balcony, up to his hips in drifted snow, tapping rather pitifully on the glass. With a surprised sound, Utina opened the door and let the robot in, then went and got a towel from one of the bathrooms and dried him off. "What are you doing here?" she asked, well aware that he couldn't answer. "Did you come looking for me? How'd you find me?" Even as she asked, she knew the answer. She looked at the controller wristwatch she wore and remembered Corwin telling her that Tiny Robo could home in on it. "Well," said Utina, picking up the little robot, "you're loyal, I'll give you that. You remind me of another little critter, except you eat a lot less."
"Urgh," said Tiny Robo.
Caitlin returned to consciousness a second time with the realization that her alarm wasn't going off. This time, a squint at her watch indicated that the reason this time was that it had gone off at the appointed time, and she'd switched it off without waking. Ah, well, she only did that when she really needed the sleep she was stealing. Besides, as her memory spun up and she looked back on the reason she'd been up until 4 a.m. the previous night, she decided the odds were very poor that she was going to classes today anyway. She sat up, stretched, lightly thumping the ceiling with her upraised fist as always, indulged in an immense and satisfying yawn, then swung her feet out the side of her bunk and dropped lightly to the floor. "Utina, are you up?" she asked the empty bottom bunk, then mused to herself,
I guess so.
She picked up her glasses from the top of her bureau, put them on, and then rummaged in the drawers for today's underclothes and shirt. These she tossed onto her desk without really looking at them. Next, she pulled her pajama top off over her head without bothering to unbutton it, tossed it up on her bed, and turned around, reaching for the bathrobe hanging on her bedpost. There was someone sitting in the brown armchair, a red-headed girl who looked a bit Kate's senior, legs crossed elegantly at the knee, regarding her very calmly over an open, about half-read copy of So You've Just Arrived from a Parallel Dimension, with the most remarkable green eyes. Kate's brown eyes locked with them for a second, and as they did so, the redhead smiled a barely perceptible, gently sardonic little smile. Kate went red all the way down to the notch of her collarbone, grabbed her pajama top and yanked it back on, nearly getting it the wrong way around.
"And you are?" she inquired.
Juri closed the book on her finger and stood up, smiling a little more fully, if guardedly. She was tall, maybe even taller than Amanda,
Kate noticed belatedly that she wore the same kind of uniform Miki Kaworu had been wearing when he'd first appeared in her family home on New Avalon. A white, rather martial jacket with epaulets and chain, and close-fitting pants, hers a peach color as opposed to Miki's blue. She had orange-gold hair and vertical curls, and an utterly lovely face with an air of cool, complete composure. Kate swallowed an involuntary wow. "Now I know how Corwin must have felt," she noted to herself. "A little lost in Cleveland." "I'm sorry to barge in this way," said the redhead in a slightly apologetic tone. Her voice was a trifle deep for a woman's, and a little husky. Kate found it eminently suitable. She went on, "I take it you're Tenjo's roommate."
Yes, said Kate.
She bowed slightly.
Caitlin Hutchins.
"It's nice to meet you, Miss Hutchins," said Juri, nodding. "I'm Juri Arisugawa."
"Oh, of course. In that outfit, who else could she be?"
"Ah," said Kate.
That explains..."
She sighed. This was going to take forever.
"Where's Utena?"
Juri shrugged just a bit. "I was hoping you could tell me. She seemed normal enough when she let me in here, but then she started swearing, got dressed in a hurry, and ran out." She gestured to the little robot, which still stood looking up at her. "Your watchbot's kept me pinned in this chair ever since." Kate frowned, too puzzled by Juri's description of Utrina's behavior to be amused by the security consciousness of Lesser Mazinger.
"What did she say?"
she asked.
"Well, apart from the profanities, the central theme seemed to be, 'Oh no, you're here.'"
Caitlin thought about that for a second, followed the logical thread to its conclusion, and sighed.
Damn,
she said, and grabbed her robe.
Wait here, she said, and left.
Juri looked after her, shrugged, and went back to reading. Kate came back from showering a few minutes later and dressed without self-consciousness now because she was too preoccupied to worry about it. As she knotted her neckerchief, she seemed to remember that Juri was there, still sitting in the armchair, politely waiting for her hostess to say something, and turned to face her again.
Look,
she began, but just then there was a knock at the door. Kate glanced toward it, then sighed and started toward it, but then it clicked and opened, admitting Azalin.
"Katie, are you up?" she asked.
"Oh, good. I got the weirdest email last night, and..." She noticed then that Kate was in the process of dressing, spotted her guest, and blinked.
"Oh, you have company. I'm sorry. I'll come back later."
Stay, said Kate flatly.
Okay,
said Azalin. Then she grinned slyly and said, "But I've only got 10 minutes until my next class." Kate rolled her eyes.
Don't make me hurt you,
she said in a dead serious tone, and Azalin dropped the joke.
"Sorry. What's the matter?"
This is Juri, said Kate, gesturing. "She's from Utena's old school."
Azalin's face fell.
"Oh, she did it again, huh?"
Kate looked taken aback.
"How did you..."
Then she shook her head.
Forget it. No time. She's disappeared. Get the others."
"Aw, man," said Azalin. "Poor Utena. She must have realized."
Kate nodded.
"Okay, I'm gone," said Azalin.
Nice to meet you, Juri. You look like a lot of fun. We'll have to talk later.
True to her word, the Dantrovian was then gone, darting out the door with just a flicker of dark gray checked skirt and pale gray tail to mark her passing.
As for you, Kate said to Juri, as she stuffed the tails of her blouse into the waistband of her skirt, come with me. We're going to find an interpreter.